The Lord be with you. Jesus is headed toward Jerusalem. This is his final road trip. So each stop along the way is a big deal. For he will never again return to these places and these people. That means that each stop along the way is the last chance he will have to do what he came to do. And what did he come to do? Recall the words of Isaiah from Jesus' first recorded sermon. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovery of sight to the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And after reading this passage, Jesus went on to tell the people that he is the one to fulfill their words. This is his mission. And each week, as we move through Luke's story, the mission comes closer to its end. Last Sunday, the story was set in the midst of a crowd of over 10,000 people. Jesus spoke of bringing fire to the earth, a sign of God's presence and salvation, something about which the crowd gathered around a religious leader should have gotten excited about. But instead, Jesus said his news would bring sharp division. Now this morning we have a crippled woman who enters the synagogue and her life is changed forever. But there are two scenes that take place between last Sunday's story and this morning's. Let me recap these two scenes. Chapter 13 begins with the first, with Jesus teaching a group of people, some of whom believe that bad things only happen to sinful people. It's what we call karma. He refers to two tragedies that had taken place around that time. First, Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor, murdered some Jewish Galileans. And secondly, 18 people died from a tower falling on them. And there were some in the crowd who thought that these people suffered such horrible deaths because they had done something wrong, that they were worse sinners than others. Just to put that in our context, it would be like saying the victims in El Paso and Dayton in the shootings in the last couple of weeks got what they deserved. They must have been really bad people to have this happen to them. And Jesus is very clear in his response. These people did not die in these tragic ways because they were worse sinners than others. And anyone who suggests that they did really ought to pay more attention to their own sins. So Jesus begins chapter 13 debunking this theology. He does not associate people's sins with the tragic things that may happen to them. Then right after this, and right before this morning's reading, Jesus tells a parable about a fig tree. It didn't bear fruit for 3 years. And the man who owned the land where the tree stood told his groundskeeper to cut it down. But the groundskeeper pleaded with him, "No, let it go one more year. I'll dig around it. I'll fertilize it. Give it some TLC. Modern translation, I think. And then we'll look for it to bear fruit. If it does, great, we have a fig tree. If it doesn't, then cut it down." So these are the two scenes that happen right before our story this morning. First, Jesus does not associate the tragedies people have experienced with the severity of their sins. In fact, he rebukes those who do. And secondly, Jesus is looking for figs on the tree, so to speak. He is looking for people whose lives show signs of this kingdom he is building. He wants to know if the fertilizer has worked. So, he stumbles into a random synagogue on a random Saturday. Now, pretty much any time we read that Jesus goes into a synagogue, especially on the Sabbath, we can pretty much assume that some Jewish leader is going to get very upset. This story is no exception. And what I find ironic about this situation is that Jesus is teaching. So the synagogue leader must have given him the okay. And there's nothing that we read here that suggests that there's anything about Jesus' teaching that upsets the synagogue leader. Everything seems to be orthodox, nothing heretical. But while he's teaching, Jesus spots a woman who is suffering from an awful physical impairment. We know very little about this woman, except that she's been bent over for 18 years. Jesus says nothing about her faith, which he often does when he heals people. But consider this. This woman who has 18 years worth of reasons to curse God, want nothing to do with God, is in worship. She came to worship. Luke makes no indication that this was a special Sunday with the guest preacher. So we have no reason to think she came to worship just because the popular healer was in town. As far as we can tell, she shows up week after week despite a tragic deformation in her spine. Remember, Jesus is looking for figs. He sees her. He calls her forward. He declares her free from her infirmity. He touches her. And she stands up straight, praising God. Some, including the synagogue leader, likely assumed that this woman was unrighteous. Why else would this have happened? It's that bad theology from the crowd. Maybe she was getting what she deserved, they thought, but Jesus saw her and knew right away. Look, a fig. You heard the story. The synagogue leader stands up and makes a stink about this happening, of all things, on the Sabbath. But notice exactly what he does. It took me a couple times reading this to catch this. He doesn't directly accuse Jesus of working on the Sabbath. He doesn't turn to Jesus and say, "Hey, no Sabbath working, you." That would be really unintimidating if he did it that way. No, instead he turns to the congregation. He turns to the people and says, "Hey, don't come here on the Sabbath to be healed." Maybe he's trying not to shame Jesus in front of all the people. He did let Jesus preach, after all. But it may be that he suffers from the same bad theology of the crowd in the previous scene. That those in need of healing are sinful and therefore are the ones to blame. Don't come in here with your disabilities and sins and make this good preacher break the Sabbath rules. Whatever the case may be, Jesus sees the synagogue leader for who he is, a hypocrite. And Jesus is not afraid of shaming this man publicly. He points out how the man cares more about his animals than he does for his people. And not just his people, God's people. You're willing to loosen the knot on the rope, keeping your ox and donkey from eating and drinking on the Sabbath? But I cannot loosen the rope keeping this woman, this child of Abraham, bound for 18 long years? If I could edit the Gospel of Luke, I would add, are you listening to yourself right now? Here comes the division that we heard that Jesus was going to bring last Sunday. Here's where Jesus is going to bring about the falling and rising up of many that Simeon foretold. He touches this woman, not a lot of work if you ask me, and she rises for the first time in 18 years. But the synagogue leader, Jesus, cuts him down like a barren fig tree. And the crowd rejoiced. In that crowd, some figs, others maybe not so much. What we've been learning, these lessons in losing our lives these last few Sundays, as we've followed Jesus on the road, we've also learned some lessons about obstacles we face on this road. And this morning we see another obstacle to following Jesus. The rules and regulations that we establish that cause us to lose sight of what God is doing. Now I want to point out that rules and regulations are most often not bad. I'll be bringing a couple of policies to the leadership team for approval in the coming weeks, and they're meant to help us do ministry well. I don't think rules and regulations are bad, and I do think that the Pharisees often get a bad rap. Their movement started out as a movement of lay people who cared about taking God's law seriously. But over time, what developed was a sort of second-order law that ultimately obscured God's intentions for the law more than it illuminated it. A good friend of mine shared a story with me from her life that painfully captures how the rules and regulations can obscure us from seeing others and seeing what God is doing. My friend is a missionary in a place that is dangerous to be a missionary. She has a brilliant mind, unbelievably intelligent, but also struggles with depression, social anxiety, and seasonal affect disorder. One Sunday morning, she was in a tough place emotionally, fighting the depression, which, by the way, is one of those conditions that in our society we tend to treat with a karma-like theology. After church, she grabbed a cup of coffee, spotted someone in the sanctuary, and set out to talk with them. And no sooner had she crossed the threshold into the sanctuary, someone lectured her, scolded her for bringing coffee into the sanctuary. It was a rule the church probably had established, either formally or informally, to protect the carpets and keep the costs of cleaning them down. Good stewardship of resources. Upset and anxious, fighting back tears, her hand began shaking. She spilled coffee all over herself, burning her hand, and the person who initially scolded her responded, "See, you're spilling all over the floor now." When she told me how she ran home, crying in the cold of winter, even all those years later, she was fighting back the tears, and so was I. What makes this obstacle to following Jesus, the rules and regulations governing how we do faith together, what makes them so sneaky and difficult to detect is that they're often put in place for good reason and sanctioned by the church. if not the whole church, a group within it. And what hits me most about my friend's story is that there are days when I, too, would respond with such an ungodly concern for the carpet and the rules governing their protection that I would miss this tender child of God who needed more than anything a word of grace and hope and encouragement. She needed someone to put a steady hand of advocacy to her back and help her stand tall. I hope that on most days I would offer that word and that hand. But there are times when we're tired, frustrated, cynical, burnt out, anxious. There are times when we may be even a bit depressed ourselves. And it's so much easier to idolize the rules and regulations than to live in and out the love of God that we meet in Jesus Christ. Friends, one of the great challenges to following Jesus together as a church is the temptation to idolize the systems and structures that make up what we think is good church. This past week, our leadership team met to begin exploring what it means when we say that we want to be an all-welcoming church family. What does it look like for us to truly welcome all? How can we be a community that embraces others no matter what crippling experience they may have? Can we be a place and a people that fosters healing for the broken, grace for the fallen? I think we can. But our reading this morning demands that we pay attention to a couple things if we are to truly be an all-welcoming church family. First, we must recognize that there are two people in this story who are crippled, or as Sally put it so well, who are bent out of shape. There is the woman whose impairment is obvious, but then there is the synagogue leader. He belongs. He's a pillar of the church. He knows what good church looks like. And he sets and abides by the rules and regulations that will maintain it. Nonetheless, he has a crippled faith. He is unable to see the new thing that God is doing to be present and bring salvation to others, the ones who don't belong, don't have a history of service on church committees, don't look the part, and can't even look you in the eye because they are bent over from the burdens of life. To be an all-welcoming church, we need to consider the possibility that we may suffer from this deeper, less obvious, crippling blindness ourselves. We must consider how comfortable we have become with our understanding of good church and whether the rules and regulations that protect it are pliable enough for us to be a community who sees and welcomes others with the love of God which cannot be contained. But we need to recognize something else. We do not simply muster up the consciousness or will to see what God is doing among us. It requires faith, a faith that transcends the rules and regulation. That sight comes to us as we exercise the kind of bold faith of this formerly crippled woman. When we show up week after week, ready to worship God with our broken bodies, perplexed minds, and messy souls. Our capacity to see and truly welcome others develops when we respond to Jesus' call to come forward and bring our crippled lives to God and be healed in whatever form that healing comes. Friends, some of us came this morning like the woman, looking for God and praying for healing. And some of us have come this morning looking for our expectations of good church to be met. For most of us, I imagine it's a bit of both. No matter how you came this morning, hear the good news. Jesus Christ is in the business of healing the broken, liberating those who are enslaved, and straightening up crippled and crooked lives. God's all-welcoming love is as available to you this morning as it was for those gathered in the synagogue in the first century, from the blind leader to the crippled woman. But wait, there's more. Jesus is not looking for perfect people who know and follow all of the rules. He is looking for anyone who will bear the fruit of his life, of his spirit, despite whatever brokenness they may be experiencing. May we, Hilltop Covenant Church, and everyone in our sphere of influence, may we be such people who earnestly seek God, who grow in our capacity to see and treat others as beloved children of God. I think we can do this.